The late Mr. Chass's rocking chair stood on faded linoleum by the door to the back porch. Lois led Ralph to it and admonished him to stay out from underfoot. Ralph thought this was an assignment he could handle. Strong light, mid-afternoon light, fell across his lap as he sat and rocked. Ralph wasn't sure how it had gotten so late so fast, but somehow it had. Maybe I fell asleep, he thought. Maybe I'm asleep right now and dreaming all this. He watched as Lois took down a wok, definitely hobbit-sized, from an overhead cupboard. 5 minutes later, savory smells began to fill the kitchen. I told you I'd cook for you someday, Lois said, adding vegetables from the fridge crisper and spices from one of the overhead cabinets. That was the same day I gave you and Bill the leftover macaroni and cheese. Do you remember? I believe I do, Ralph said, smiling. There's a jug of fresh cider in the milk box on the front porch. Cider always keeps best outside. Would you get it? You can pour out, too. My good glasses are in the cupboard over the sink, the one I can't reach without dragging over a chair. You're tall enough to do without the chair, I judge. What are you, Ralph? About 6'2"?
6'3". At least I was. I guess maybe I've lost an inch or two in the last 10 years. Your spine settles or something. And you don't have to go putting on the dog just for me. Honest.
She looked at him levelly, hands on hips, the spoon with which she had been stirring the contents of the wok jutting from one of them. Her severity was offset by a trace of a smile. I said my good glasses, Ralph Roberts, not my best glasses.
Yes, ma'am, he said, grinning, then added, from the way that smells, I guess you still remember how to cook for a man.
The proof of the pudding is in the eating, Lois replied. But Ralph thought she looked pleased as she turned back to the wok. The food was good, and they didn't talk about what had happened in the park as they applied themselves to it. Ralph's appetite had become uncertain, out more often than in, since his insomnia had really begun to bite. But today he ate heartily, and chased Lois's spicy stir-fry with 3 glasses of apple cider, hoping uneasily as he finished the last one that the rest of the day's activities wouldn't take him too far from a toilet. When they had finished, Lois got up, went to the sink, and began to draw hot water for dishes. As she did, she resumed their earlier conversation as if it were a half-finished piece of knitting which had been temporarily laid aside for some other, more pressing chore. What did you do to me? She asked him. What did you do to make the colors come back?
I don't know.
It was as if I was on the edge of that world, and when you put your hands over my eyes, you pushed me into it. He nodded, remembering how she'd looked in the first few seconds after he'd removed his hands, as if she'd just taken off a pair of goggles which had been dipped in powdered sugar. It was pure instinct. And you're right, it is like a world. I keep thinking of it just that way, as the world of auras. It's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, it's scary, and when it first started to happen to me, back in late July or early August this was, I was sure I was going crazy. But even then, I liked it, too. I couldn't help liking it. Ralph gazed at her, startled. Had he once upon a time thought of Lois as transparent, gossipy, unable to keep a secret? No, I'm afraid it was a little worse than that, old buddy. You thought she was shallow. You saw her pretty much through Bill's eyes, as a matter of fact, as our Lois. No less, but not much more. What? She asked a little uneasily. Why are you looking at me like that? You've been seeing these auras since summer? That long? Yes, brighter and brighter, also more often. That's why I finally went to see the tattletale. Did I really shoot that thing with my finger, Ralph? The more time goes by, the less I can believe that part of it.
You did. I did something like it myself shortly before I ran into you.
He told her about his earlier confrontation with Dock Number 3, and about how he had banished the dwarf, temporarily at least. He raised his hand to his shoulder and brought it swiftly down. That's all I did, like a kid pretending to be Chuck Norris or Steven Seagal. but it sent this incredible bolt of blue light at him, and he scurried in a hurry, which was probably for the best because I couldn't have done it again. I don't know how I did that either. Could you have shot your finger again? Lois giggled, turned toward him, and cocked her finger in his general direction. Want to find out? Kapow! Kablam!
Don't point that thing at me, lady, Ralph told her.
He smiled as he said it, but wasn't entirely sure he was joking. Lois lowered her finger and squirted joy into the sink. As she began to stir the water around with one hand, puffing up the suds, she asked what Ralph thought of as the big questions. Where did this power come from, Ralph? And what's it for? He shook his head as he got up and walked over to the dish drainer. I don't know, and I don't know. How's that for helpful? Where do you keep your dish wipers, Lois? Never mind where I keep my dish wipers. Go sit down. Please tell me you're not one of these modern men, Ralph. The ones that are always hugging each other and bawling. Ralph laughed and shook his head. Nope, I was just well trained, that's all. Okay, as long as you don't start going on about how sensitive you are. There are some things a girl likes to find out for herself. She opened the cupboard under the sink and tossed him a faded but scrupulously clean dish towel. Just dry them and put them on the counter. I'll put them away myself. While you're working, you can tell me your story. The unabridged version. You got a deal. He was still wondering where to begin when his mouth opened, seemingly of its own accord, and began for him. When I finally started to get it through my head that Carolyn was going to die, I went for a lot of walks, and one day, while I was out on the extension, he told her everything, beginning with his intervention between Ed and the fat man wearing the West Side Gardener's gimme cap, and ending with Bill telling him that he'd better go see his doctor, because at their age, mental illness was common. At their age, it was common as hell. He had to double back several times to pick up dropped stitches, the way old Dor had showed up in the middle of his efforts to keep Ed from going at the man from West Side Gardeners, for instance. But he didn't mind doing that, and Lois didn't seem to have any trouble keeping his narrative straight, either. The overall feeling Ralph was conscious of as he wound his way through his tale was a relief so deep it was nearly painful. It was as if someone had stacked bricks on his heart and mind, and he was now removing them, one by one. By the time he was finished, the dishes were done, and they had left the kitchen in favor of the living room with its dozens of framed photographs, presided over by Mr. Chass from his place on the TV. So, Ralph said, how much of it do you believe? All of it, of course, she said, and either did not notice the expression of relief on Ralph's face or chose to ignore it. After what we saw this morning, not to mention what you knew about my wonderful daughter-in-law, I can't very well not believe. That's my advantage over Bill. Not your only one, Ralph thought, but didn't say. None of this stuff is coincidental, is it? She asked him. Ralph shook his head. No, I don't think so. When I was 17, she said, my mother hired this boy from down the road, Richard Henderson, his name was, to do chores around our place. There were a lot of boys she could have hired, but she hired Richie because she liked him. And she liked him for me, if you understand what I mean. Of course I do. She was matchmaking. Uh-huh. But at least she wasn't doing it in a big, gruesome, embarrassing way. Thank God, because I didn't care a fig for Richie, at least not like that. Still, Mother gave it her very best. If I was studying my books at the kitchen table, she'd have him loading the wood box, even though it was May and already hot. If I was feeding the chickens, she'd have Richie cutting side hay next to the dooryard. She wanted me to see him around, to get used to him. And if we got to like each other's company, and he asked me to a dance or the town fair, that would have been just fine with her. It was gentle, but it was there. A push. And that's what this is like. The pushes don't feel all that gentle to me, Ralph said. His hand went involuntarily to the place where Charlie Pickering had pricked him with the point of his knife. No, of course they don't. Having a man stick a knife in your ribs like that must have been horrible. Thank God you had that spray can. Do you suppose old Dor sees the auras too? That something from that world told him to put the can in your pocket? Ralph gave a helpless shrug. What she was suggesting had crossed his mind, but once you got beyond it, the ground really started to slope away. Because if Dorrance had done that, it suggested that some entity, force, or being had known that Ralph would need help. Nor was that all. That force, or being, would also have had to know that A, Ralph would be going out on Sunday afternoon, that B, the weather, quite nice up until then, would turn nasty enough to require a jacket, and C, which jacket he would wear. You were talking, in other words, about something that could foretell the future. The idea that he had been noticed by such a force frankly scared the hell out of him. He recognized that in the case of the aerosol can, at least, the intervention had probably saved his life, but it still scared the hell out of him. Maybe, he said, maybe something did use Dorrance as an errand boy, but why? And what do we do now? She added. Ralph could only shake his head. She glanced up at the clock squeezed in between the picture of the man in the raccoon coat and the young woman who looked ready to say 23 skidoo any old time, then reached for the phone. Almost 3:30, my goodness! Ralph touched her hand. Who are you calling? Simone Castengay. I've made plans to go over to Ludlow with her and Minna this afternoon. There's a card party at the Grange. But I can't go after all this. I'd lose my shirt. She laughed, then colored prettily. Just a figure of speech. Ralph put his hand over hers before she could lift the receiver. Go on to your card party, Lois. Really? She looked both doubtful and a little disappointed. Yes. He was still unclear about what was going on here, but he sensed that was about to change. Lois had spoken of being pushed, but to Ralph it felt more as if he were being carried, the way a river carries a man in a small boat. But he couldn't see where he was going. Heavy mist shrouded the banks, and now, as the current began to grow swifter, he could hear the rumble of rapids somewhere up ahead. Still there are shapes, Ralph. Shapes in the mist. Yes, not very comforting ones either. They might be trees that only looked like clutching fingers. But on the other hand, they might be clutching fingers trying to look like trees. Until Ralph knew which was the case, he liked the idea of Lois's being out of town just fine. He had a strong intuition, or perhaps it was only hope masquerading as intuition, that Dock Number 3 couldn't follow her to Ludlow, that he might not even be able to follow her across the barrens to the east side. You can't know any such thing, Ralph. Maybe not, but it felt right. And he was still convinced that in the world of the auras, feeling and knowing were pretty nearly the same thing. One thing he did know was that Dock Number 3 hadn't cut Lois's balloon string yet. That Ralph had seen for himself, along with the joyously healthy gray glow of her aura. Yet Ralph could not escape a growing certainty that Dock Number 3, crazy Dock, intended to cut it, and that no matter how lively Rosalie had looked when she went trotting away from Strawford Park, the severing of that cord was a mortal, murderous act. Let's say you're right, Ralph. Let's say he can't get at her this afternoon if she's playing nickel in, dime or out in Ludlow. What about tonight? Tomorrow? Next week? What's the solution? Does she call up her son and her bitch of a daughter-in-law, tell them she's changed her mind about Riverview Estates and wants to go there after all? He didn't know, but he knew he needed time to think, and he also knew that constructive thinking would be hard to do until he was fairly sure that Lois was safe, at least for a while. Ralph, you're getting that moogie look again. That what look? Moogie. She tossed her hair pertly. That's a word I made up to describe how Mr. Chass looked when he was pretending to listen to me but was actually thinking about his coin collection. I know a moogie look when I see one, Ralph. What are you thinking about? I was wondering what time you think you'll get back from your card game.
That depends.
On what?
On whether or not we stop at Tubby's for chocolate fraps.
She spoke with the air of a woman revealing a secret vice.
Suppose you come straight back.
7 o'clock? Maybe 7:30?
Call me as soon as you get home. Would you do that?
Yes.
You want me out of town, don't you?
That's what that moogie look really means.
Well, you think that nasty bald thing means to hurt me, don't you?
I think it's a possibility.
Well, he might hurt you, too.
Yes, but...
But as far as I can tell, Lois, he's not wearing any of my fashion accessories.
But what?
I'm going to be okay until you get back, that's all.
He remembered her deprecating remark about modern men hugging each other and bawling, and tried for a masterful frown.
Go play cards and leave this business to me, at least for the time being.
That's an order.
Carolyn would have either laughed or gotten angry at such comic opera macho posturing. Lois, who belonged to an entirely different school of feminine thought, only nodded and looked grateful to have the decision taken out of her hands.
All right.
She tilted his chin down so she could look directly into his eyes.
Do you know what you're doing, Ralph?
Nope. Not yet, anyway.
All right, just as long as you admit it. She placed a hand on his forearm and a soft, open-mouthed kiss on the corner of his mouth. Ralph felt an entirely welcome prickle of heat in his groin.
I'll go to Ludlow and win $5 playing poker with those silly women who are always trying to fill their inside straits. Tonight we'll talk about what to do next. Okay?
Yes. A small smile, a thing more in the eyes than of the mouth, suggested that they might do a little more than just talk if Ralph was bold. And at that moment he felt quite bold indeed.
Not even Mr. Chass's stern gaze from his place atop the TV affected that feeling very much.
It was 3:45 by the time Ralph crossed the street and walked the short distance back up the hill to his own building. Weariness was stealing over him again. He felt as if he'd been up for roughly 3 centuries. Yet at the same time, he felt better than he had since Carolyn had died. More together, more himself.
Or is that maybe just what you want to believe? That a person can't feel this miserable without some sort of positive payback?
It's a lovely idea, Ralph, but not very realistic.
All right, he thought. So maybe I'm a little confused right now.
Indeed he was. Also frightened, exhilarated, disoriented, and a touch horny. Yet one clear idea came through this mix of emotions. One thing he needed to do before he did anything else. He had to make up with Bill. If that meant apologizing, he could do that. Maybe an apology was even in order. Bill, after all, hadn't come to him saying, "Gee, old buddy, you look terrible, tell me all about it." No, he had gone to Bill. He had done so with misgivings, true, but that didn't change the fact, and...
Ah, Ralph, geez, what am I going to do with you?
It was Carolyn's amused voice, speaking to him clearly as it had during the weeks following her death, when he'd handled the worst of his grief by discussing everything with her inside his head, and sometimes aloud if he happened to be alone in the apartment.
Bill was the one who blew his top, sweetie, not you. I see you're just as determined to be hard on yourself now as you were when I was alive. I guess some things never change.
Ralph smiled a little. Yeah, okay, maybe some things never did change. And maybe the argument had been more Bill's fault than his.
The question was whether or not he wanted to cut himself off from Bill's companionship over a stupid quarrel and a lot of stiff-necked horseshit about who had been right and who had been wrong. Ralph didn't think he did. And if that meant making an apology Bill didn't really deserve, what was so awful about that?
So far as he knew, there were no bones in the 3 little syllables that made up, "I'm sorry."
The Carolyn inside his head responded to this idea with wordless incredulity.
"Never mind," he told her as he started up the walk. "I'm doing this for me, not for him. Or for you, as far as that goes."
He was amazed and amused to discover how guilty that last thought made him feel, almost as if he had committed an act of sacrilege. But that didn't make the thought any less true. He was feeling around in his pocket for his latchkey when he saw a note thumbtacked to the door. Ralph felt for his glasses, but he had left them upstairs on the kitchen table. He leaned back, squinting to read Bill's scrawling hand. "Dear Ralph, Lois, Fay, whoever, I expect to be spending most of the day at Derry Home. Bob Paulhurst's niece called and told me that this time it's almost certainly the real thing. The poor man has almost finished his struggle. Room 313 in Derry Home ICU is about the last place on earth I want to be on a beautiful day in October. But I guess I'd better see this through to the end. Ralph, I'm sorry I gave you such a hard time this morning. You came to me for help, and I damn near clawed your face off instead. All I can say by way of apology is that this thing with Bob has completely wrecked my nerves. Okay? I think I owe you a dinner, if you still want to eat with the likes of me, that is. Fay, please, 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 quit bugging me about your damn chess tournament. I promised I'd play, and I keep my promises. Goodbye, cruel world. Bill." Ralph straightened up with a feeling of relief and gratitude. If only everything else that had been happening to him lately could straighten itself out as easily as this part had done. He went upstairs, shook the tea kettle, and was filling it at the sink when the telephone rang. It was John Lydecker. "Boy, I'm glad I finally got hold of you," he said. "I was getting a little worried, old buddy." "Why?" Ralph asked. "What's wrong?" "Maybe nothing. Maybe something. Charlie Pickering made bail after all."
"You told me that wouldn't happen."
"I was wrong, okay," Lydecker said, clearly irritated. "It wasn't the only thing I was wrong about either. I told you the judge had probably set bail in the $40,000 range. But I didn't know Pickering was going to draw Judge Stedman, who has been known to say that he doesn't even believe in insanity. Stedman set bail at $80,000. Pickering's court-appointed bellowed like a calf in the moonlight, but it didn't make any difference." Ralph looked down and saw he was still holding the tea kettle in one hand. He put it on the table.
"And he still made bail?"
"Yep. Remember me telling you that Ed would throw him away like a paring knife with a broken blade?"
"Yes."
"Well, score it as another strikeout for John Lydecker. Ed marched into the bailiff's office at 11 o'clock this morning with a briefcase full of money."
$8,000? Ralph asked.
"I said briefcase, not envelope," Lydecker replied. "Not eight, but 80. They're still buzzing down at the courthouse. Hell, they'll be buzzing about it even after the Christmas tinsel comes down."
Ralph tried to imagine Ed Deepnow in one of his baggy old sweaters and a pair of worn corduroys. Ed's mad scientist outfits, Carolyn had called them, pulling banded stacks of 20s and 50s out of his briefcase, and couldn't do it.
"I thought you said 10% was enough to get out." "It is if it can also escrow something. A house or a piece of property, for instance, that stacks up somewhere near the total bail amount. Apparently Ed couldn't do that, but he did have a little rainy day cash under the mattress. Either that or he gave the tooth fairy one hell of a blowjob."
Ralph found himself remembering the letter he had gotten from Helen about a week after she had left the hospital and moved out to High Ridge. She had mentioned a check she had gotten from Ed, $750. "It seems to indicate he understands his responsibilities," she had written. Ralph wondered if Helen would still feel that way if she knew that Ed had walked into the Derry County Courthouse with enough money to send his daughter sailing through the first 15 years of her life, and pledged it to free a crazy guy who liked to play with knives and Molotov cocktails.
"Where in God's name did he get it?" he asked Lydecker. "Don't know."
"And he isn't required to say?"
"Nope. It's a free country. I understand he said something about cashing in some stocks."
Ralph thought back to the old days. The good old days before Carolyn had gotten sick and died, and Ed had just gotten sick.
thought back to meals the four of them had had together once every 2 weeks or so. Take out pizza at the Deep Nose, or maybe Carol's chicken pot pie in the Roberts' kitchen. And remembered Ed saying on one occasion that he was going to treat them all to prime rib at the Red Lion in Bangor when his stock accounts matured. That's right, Helen had replied, smiling at Ed fondly. She'd been pregnant then, just beginning to show, and looking all of 14 with her hair pulled back in a ponytail and wearing a checkered smock that was still yards too big for her. Which do you think will mature first, Edward? The 2,000 shares of United Toe Jam or the 6,000 of Amalgamated Sour Balls? And he'd growled at her, a growl that had made them all laugh, because Ed Deepnoe didn't have a mean bone in his body. Anyone who had known him more than 2 weeks knew that Ed wouldn't hurt a fly. Except Helen might have known a little different. Even back then, Helen had almost surely known a little different. Fond look or no fond look. Ralph, Lydecker asked, are you still there? Ed didn't have any stocks, Ralph said. He was a research chemist, for Christ's sake, and his father was foreman in a bottling plant in some crazy place like Plaster Rock, Pennsylvania. No dough there. Well, he got it somewhere, and I'd be lying if I said I liked it. From the other friends of life, do you think? No, I don't. First, we're not talking rich folks here. Most of the people who belong to the Friends are blue-collar types, working-class heroes. They give what they can, but this much? No. They could have gotten together enough property deeds among them to spring Pickering, I suppose, but they didn't. Most of them wouldn't even if Ed had asked. Ed's all but persona non grata with them now, and I imagine they wish they'd never heard of Charlie Pickering. Dan Dalton's taken back the leadership of the Friends of Life, and to most of them, that's a big relief. Ed and Charlie and two other people, a man named Frank Felton and a woman named Sandra McKay, seem to be operating very much on their own hook now. Felton, I don't know anything about, and there's no jacket on him, but the McKay woman has toured some of the same fine institutions as Charlie. She's unmissable, too. Pasty complexion, lots of acne, glasses so thick they make her eyes look like poached eggs. Goes about 300 pounds. You joking? No. She favors stretch pants from Kmart and can usually be observed traveling in the company of assorted ding-dongs, funny bones, and hostess Twinkies. She often wears a big sweatshirt with the words Baby Factory on the front. Claims to have given birth to 15 children. She's never actually had any, and probably can't. Why are you telling me all this? Because I want you to watch out for these people, Lydecker said. He spoke patiently, as if to a child. They may be dangerous. Charlie is, for sure. That you know without me telling you. And Charlie is out. Where Ed got the money to spring him is secondary. He got it. That's what matters. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he came after you again. Him or Ed or the others. What about Helen and Natalie? They're with their friends. Friends who are very hip to the dangers posed by screw-loose hubbies. I filled Mike Hanlon in, and he'll also keep an eye on her. The library is being watched very closely by our men. We don't think Helen's in any real danger at the present time. She is still staying at High Ridge, but we're doing what we can. Thank you, John. I appreciate that. And I appreciate the call. I appreciate that you appreciate it, but I'm not quite done yet. You need to remember who Ed called and threatened, my friend. Not Helen, but you. She doesn't seem to be much of a concern to him anymore, but you linger on his mind, Ralph. I asked Chief Johnson if I could assign a man. Chris Nell would be my pick, to keep an eye on you. At least until After Woman Care's rent-a-bitch has come and gone. I was turned down. Too much going on this week, he said. But the way I was turned down suggests to me that if you asked, you'd get someone to watch your back. So what do you say? Police protection, Ralph thought. That's what they call it on the TV cop shows. And that's what he's talking about. Police protection. He tried to consider the idea, but too many other things got in the way. They danced in his head like weird sugar plums. Hats, ducks, smocks, spray cans, not to mention knives, scalpels, and a pair of scissors glimpsed in the dusty lenses of his old binoculars. Each thing I do, I rush through so I can do something else, Ralph thought. And on the heels of that, it's a long walk back to Eden, sweetheart, so don't sweat the small stuff.
No, he said.
What? Ralph closed his eyes and saw himself picking up this same phone and calling to cancel his appointment with a pin sticker man. This was the same thing all over again, wasn't it? Yes, he could get police protection from the Pickerings and the McKays and the Feltons, but that wasn't the way this was supposed to go. He knew that, felt it in every beat of his heart and pulse of his blood.
You heard me, he said. I don't want police protection.
For God's sake, why?
I can take care of myself, Ralph said, and grimaced a little at the pompous absurdity of this sentiment, which he had heard expressed in John Wayne Westerns without number. Ralph, I hate to be the one to break the news to you, but you're old. You got lucky on Sunday. You might not get lucky again.
I didn't just get lucky, Ralph thought. I've got friends in high places. Or maybe I should say, entities in high places.
I'll be okay, he said.
Lydecker sighed.
If you change your mind, will you call me?
Yes.
And if you see either Pickering or a large lady with thick glasses and stringy blonde hair hanging around, I'll call you. Ralph, please think this over. Just a guy parked down the street is all I'm talking about.
Done bun can't be undone, Ralph said.
Huh?
I said I appreciate it, but no. I'll be talking to you. Ralph gently replaced the telephone in its cradle. Probably John was right, he thought. Probably he was crazy. Yet he had never felt so completely sane in his life.
Tired, he told his sunny, empty kitchen, but sane.
He paused, then added,
also halfway to being in love, maybe.
That made him grin, and he was still grinning when he finally put the kettle on to heat. He was on his second cup of tea when he remembered what Bill had said in his note about owing him a meal. He decided on the spur of the moment to ask Bill to meet him at daybreak sundown for a little supper. They could start over. I think we have to start over, he thought, because that little psycho has got his hat, and I'm pretty sure that means he's in trouble. Well, no time like the present. He picked up the phone and dialed a number he had no trouble remembering. 941-5000. The number of Derry Home Hospital. The hospital receptionist connected him with room 313. The clearly tired woman who answered the phone was Denise Paulhurst, the dying man's niece. Bill wasn't there, she told him. Four other teachers from what she termed Unc's Glory Days had shown up around one, and Bill had proposed lunch. Ralph even knew how his downstairs tenant would have put it. Better belated than never. It was one of his favorites. When Ralph asked her if she expected him back soon, Denise Paulhurst said she did. He's been so faithful. I don't know what I would have done without him, Mr. Robbins.
Roberts, he said. Bill made Mr. Paulhurst sound like a wonderful man.
Yes, they all feel that way. But of course the Bills won't be coming back to his fan club, will they?
No, Ralph said uncomfortably. I suppose not. Bill's note said your uncle is very low.
Yes. The doctor says he probably won't last the day, let alone the night. But I've heard that song before. God forgive me, but sometimes it's like Uncle Bob's one of those ads from Publishers Clearing House. Always promising, never delivering. I suppose that sounds awful, but I'm too tired to care. They turned off the life support stuff this morning. I couldn't have taken the responsibility all by myself, but I called Bill, and he said it was what Unc would have wanted.
It's time for Bob to explore the next world, he said. He's mapped this one to a nicety.
Isn't that poetic, Mr. Robbins?
Yes. It's Roberts, Miss Paulhurst. Will you tell Bill that Ralph Roberts called and would like him to call back?
So we turned it off, and I was all prepared, nerved up, I guess you'd say. And then he didn't die. I can't understand it. He's ready. I'm ready. His life's work is done. So why won't he die?
I don't know. Death is very stupid, she said, speaking in the nagging and unlovely voice which only the very tired and the deeply heartsick seem to employ. An obstetrician this slow in cutting a baby's umbilical cord would be fired for malpractice.
Ralph's mind had a tendency to drift these days, but this time it snapped back in a hurry.
What did you say?
Beg your pardon. She sounded startled, as if her own mind had been drifting.
You said something about cutting the cord.
I didn't mean anything, she said.
That nagging tone had grown stronger. Except it wasn't nagging, Ralph realized. It was whining, and it was frightened.
Something was wrong here. His heartbeat suddenly speeded up.
I didn't mean anything at all, she insisted.
And suddenly the phone Ralph was holding turned a deep and sinister shade of blue in his hand.
She's been thinking about killing him, and not just idly either. She's been thinking about putting a pillow over his face and smothering him with it. It wouldn't take long, she thinks. A mercy, she thinks. Over at last, she thinks.
Ralph pulled the phone away from his ear. Blue light, cold as a February sky, rose in pencil-thin rays from the holes in the earpiece.
Murder is blue, Ralph thought, holding the phone at arm's length and staring with wide-eyed unbelief as the blue rays began to bend and drip toward the floor. He could hear very faintly the quacking, anxious voice of Denise Paulhurst.
It wasn't anything I ever wanted to know, but I guess I know it anyway. Murder is blue.
He brought the handset toward his mouth again, cocking it to keep the top half with its freight of icicle aura away from him. He was afraid that if that end of the handset got too close to his ear, it might deafen him with her cold and furious desperation.
"Tell Bill that Ralph called," he said. "Roberts, not Robbins."
He hung up without waiting for a reply. The blue rays shattered away from the phone's earpiece and tumbled toward the floor. Ralph was again reminded of icicles, this time of how they fell in a neat row when you ran your gloved hand along the underside of an eave after a warm winter day. They disappeared before they hit the linoleum. He glanced around. Nothing in the room glowed, shimmered, or vibrated. The auras were gone again. He began to let out a sigh of relief, and then, from outside on Harris Avenue, a car backfired. In the empty second-floor apartment, Ralph Roberts screamed.